Hello and joining you after a weekend in professional cycling when Tadej Pogacar responded to grumbles on the cycling podcast about his boring 70km breakaway in Strade Bianche by crashing before the Cipressa, cracking his frame and winning Milan-San Remo by approximately 70mm. My name's Daniel Freeba, I'm the host of this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll examine some of Pog's newly unveiled excitement farming techniques on the Ligurian Riviera and look ahead to a fascinating week of Pog free racing in Belgium and Catalunya. Joining me to do that today is a man whose absence from La Classicissima on Saturday promises to ask whether the Slov aliens' victory even really counts on his palmarès. It's the Motown maestro, Tudor Pro Cycling's Larry Warbass. Larry, you were absent, so can we even consider it a monument victory
in your absence? I mean, if I'm not in the monument, I guess the victory doesn't count, you know, at least not to me, right?
Yeah. You usually do Milan-San Remo, but you were...
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done it the last 2 years, but I would say I did it most of the years before that, so I've probably done it 5 times or something.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Different schedule for you this year. You've just been explaining to me that you're going up to Sierra Nevada in a couple of days for your pre-Giro altitude block. Currently, you're sunning yourself on a beautiful Mediterranean terrace, as am I. I'm in Mallorca. You're in south of France at home. But Larry, generally, how are things?
Yeah, going pretty well. I had a few days off after I did Strada Tirreno and then Milano Torino, and then I took about 4 or 5 days off the bike, and then went skiing on the weekend. That was nice.
Where were you skiing, in fact?
In Isola 2000. So okay. Where we often go for altitude training, but yeah, it's only an hour and a half drive from Nice, so went up just for the weekend, just to switch off a bit from cycling. But obviously still had to tune into the final of San Remo. And yeah, it was good to watch. So yeah, it was a nice few days off. Now I'm back to the grind. So yeah.
You're back at it. And you'll be saying farewell to your beautiful Côte d'Azur abode temporarily in a couple of days. Larry, we're going to start. We're going to have a couple of news items, and then we're going to go on to talk about Milan-San Remo. We're going to start with a couple of other farewells. The first one regards a rider, or is from a rider, who has very much characterized the era in which you've been in professional cycling. Let's hear from him. Let's hear what he had to say earlier this week, right now.
El día de hoy he venido a contarles que es el...
So, Larry, Nairo Mann announced, in typical Nairo sort of presidential address fashion, I don't know if Larry, hopefully it's many years away, you'll be retiring. I don't know whether you'll sort of summon the world's media and announce your farewell in a similar fashion. But Nairo Quintana announced a couple of days ago that he will be retiring at the end of the year, Larry. And well, probably when he does retire at the end of the year, he says it's going to be a year of parties at every race. So we look forward to that. But we will probably talk again about his career and his legacy. But it did prompt me to just to look back, Larry, on what he has achieved. As I say, you've been in the peloton most of the time. He has. He's just turned 36, Quintana. A lot of GC victories over the years. Giro d'Italia, Vuelta, most famously. He won Tirreno twice, País Vasco, Basque Country, Romandie, Burgos, Tour de Provence. 51 wins.
Wow.
In total. But I suppose a legacy that goes beyond just those bare numbers, really, when we think of the 20 teens, so 2010 to 2020, one of the big phenomena in professional cycling was the re-emergence of the Colombians, and maybe even more so than Egan Bernal, who became the first Colombian to win the Tour de France. And this was really, well, it was catalyzed by Nairo Mann, wasn't it? And this, not only his results in the way road, but also this demeanor that he had, this almost sort of mystical air about Nairo. I said there, it was a sort of a presidential address when he announced his retirement the other day. But everything he's done in his career, it has had the air, this sort of mystical, shamanic air almost, as though he's talking directly into the psyche of the Colombian nation.
I mean, he does look like he could be a shaman, actually. But yes. I don't know. I mean, the thing is, I think from what I've heard is he's bigger than cycling in Colombia. You know, he's like a super, super big figure there. So I guess that then fits with his presidential address, you know. But yeah, he's definitely been a big part of cycling over the last decade, good and bad, I'd say.
Well, yeah, I was going to mention that in the footnotes. Certainly.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what you're probably referring to. So, in just to remind the listeners, in 2020, well, there were a series of raids on the Tour de France. His room was searched, and various fairly incriminating evidence. We learned later it was incriminating evidence was seized, and his doctor. Freddy Gonzalez Torres was actually charged and convicted for attempting to dope. It wasn't, Nairo himself and his brother didn't suffer any consequences from this, but that was the inference that they were the riders that he was trying to dope. So there was that. And then in 2022, he had an excellent Tour de France. He finished sixth on general classification, but was subsequently, he lost that result, wasn't banned, but tramadol, the substance he tested positive for, the painkiller he tested positive for, was restricted, effectively banned in UCI competition. So he lost that sixth place. And that sort of precipitated, it was the beginning of the end of the Arkea team, really. He parted company with them shortly afterwards. And that certainly casts a long shadow over his whole career, I would suggest.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's a... Yeah, it's a decent shadow. So, yeah, but I mean, you know, I guess that's happened numerous times in cycling. So, but yeah, I mean, he definitely got a lot of results over that period. And yeah, was one of the bigger name riders for quite a lot of years.
Indeed, Larry. So that was one sort of farewell we were given advance notice of this week. Another sad farewell this week was from the former Giro d'Italia race director, Carmine Castellano, who passed away at the age of 89. Now Castellano was the Giro d'Italia race director from 1993 to 2003. He actually did another couple of years sort of with Angelo Zomignan. But someone we always used to see at the Giro, obviously. We have still seen him in the last few years. Whenever the Giro d'Italia was down near Naples, Sorrento was where he was from. He would always come into the press room and sort of shake everyone's hand. And he was that sort of figure, a real kind of ambassadorial figure, and someone who did an awful lot for the Giro d'Italia as race director. He first got involved in the Giro in the 1970s. He was involved in sort of organising committee of a stage that was taking place in his home region, so near Sorrento. And then he sort of looked after the southern stages for many years until he became the race director in 1993. So a real sort of ambassador for the Giro d'Italia in the south of Italy as well, because, as we know, Italy is sort of economically divided, culturally divided into north and south, and there hadn't been a southern winner of the Giro d'Italia until Danilo Di Luca, which was in the early 2000s. So Castellano sort of was very important as well in kind of raising a flag for the south of Italy. Among his other legacies, the discoveries of certain very famous climbs. So the Zoncolan first appeared under Castellano from its less famous side, but also climbs like the Colle delle Finestre and the Mortirolo. Castellano featured in a Kilometer Zero we did in 2019 about the Mortirolo and about his discovery as well of the Mortirolo. He spoke to me then, and I think we can just hear a little clip of that now, and we may repost that Kilometer Zero episode about the Mortirolo sort of in tribute to Castellano later this week.
Allora, il Mortirolo è nato così. 88, mi pare, è stato l'anno
del... The Mortirolo was born in 1988, in the infamous year of the snow on the Gavia. After that, there was a lot of controversy about a stage which, they said, had flirted with tragedy, with riders getting to Bormio frozen stiff. A few months later, we went back to the Valtellina for the Trofeo degli Scalatori, which used to be three or four stages long. That particular year, we did the Gavia, the Madesimo, and one other climb whose name I can't remember. Anyway, on one of the evenings we slept in Sondrio, in the hotel in the main square, and a friend who used to help us with events in the Valtellina came to eat with us, as did Mario Coltelli, the Italian national skiing coach, who's also from the Valtellina. After dinner we started talking about climbs, and I was lamenting the fact that the climbs that did real damage were 2,500 or 2,600 metres high. They said no, there was a climb just up the road that was only 1,900 metres high, but every bit as hard as the Stelvio, and which you could also go up in any weather. The Mortirolo, they called it. They said that we could go to see it the following morning, that they picked me up early, and that it'd take about an hour. So that's what we did, and sure enough, I was bowled over, because it didn't let up for a minute. Narrow road, curves which killed any momentum. Right there and then, I said, OK, let's give it a shot.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Larry, you assured us that in spite of your little skiing trip at the weekend, wasn't it, you were keeping a very keen eye on your teammates, your Tudor Pro Cycling teammates, but also Milan Sanremo in general. We talked about it. Lionel and I talked about it. Lionel, incidentally, is not here today because, Larry, we had to fit this episode in around your training schedule. Your training schedule and Lionel's training schedule weren't compatible this week, hence why it's just you. Anyway, Lionel and I obviously discussed what we agreed was an electrifying was the adjective I used, Milan Sanremo, on Saturday night for Arrivé. A little bit more dust has settled since then, Larry. A lot has been said about what an amazing race it was. It was an amazing achievement. It was for Pogacar. But what are your sort of main takeaways? Or what were your main takeaways while you watched?
Yeah, I mean, okay, in the end, I thought that Tade would win, but I didn't expect the race to go down as it did, you know? But I don't know who was saying this. Maybe yesterday I wrote with Kevin Vermaak, and I think he was saying that, I don't know if he read this somewhere or heard it somewhere, but that someone was saying, and I agree with this, is that this crash of Tade and the others actually like maybe played into his hands because it made the effort for the Cipressa longer, you know, because in the end, the guys like Vanderpoel and, you know, I don't know who else.
Van Aert.
I guess Van Aert, you know, it changed like a 9-minute effort into maybe a 15-minute effort, you know? Mm. And that actually definitely plays into the hands of Pogacar, which I thought that was kind of an interesting thought, and I think that's also true. But yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to see how it played out. I think we saw a lot bigger group behind this year because there was this crash, and then I think there was a bit of hesitation at the bottom. Not that it was like they were going slow, but I think if there was no crash before and UAE had gone into the bottom and started pacing straight from the gun, I think the pace would have been a lot higher, the whole Cipressa. And I think there would have been a smaller group there and then, you know, into the bottom of Poggio. So That's interesting. I think it's super impressive that Tadej was still able to win because, you know, it's not exactly a race that suits him incredibly well because he's not, I mean, he's obviously the best rider in the world, but, you know, he's more of a climber than, you know, he doesn't have like the world's best sprint, but after 300K, his sprint's pretty damn good. So, you know, I still think no one would have even maybe called him to win with a K to go, you know, because I'd still say Pidcock in my head would have a bigger, better kick than Tadej. But, you know, even leading it out from the front, he was still able to take the victory. So that was pretty crazy.
Yeah, I think we need to give Pidcock a few more flowers. A few of our listeners after Ivy the weekend said that we hadn't focused enough. We hadn't talked enough about how impressive Pidcock's ride was. And we'll endeavor to do that in a few minutes. But, Larry, I just wanted to go back to what you said about the moment when he did crash, and well, I mentioned in the intro, we've subsequently learned that he also cracked his frame. How much impact that had, we do not know. But when he did crash, we then saw at the bottom of the Cipressa teams who we didn't necessarily expect to see at the front of the peloton up there. I think it was Foldegar, I saw Jaco Alula.
Yeah,
and Ineos were there as well, and there were a couple of other teams sort of sniffing around. And it was difficult. It's always difficult to tell on TV how fast exactly they're going. And I suppose the only measure, or the measure that a lot of people use, was how quickly and easily Pogacar seemed to be going through them, and from that they deduced that actually the pace wasn't that high. Sort of giving lie to that a little bit was the fact that he did ultimately break the record on the Cipressa. But I listened to a French podcast this morning in which they were speaking as though they were comparing it to, Larry, I don't know whether you're too young for this, but 2003, very famously, Lance Armstrong crashed on Lussardi-Den in the Tour de France, and he sort of collided with the spectators. He got snagged on a spectator's musette.
I definitely remember that.
Musette, there you go. And, well, this caused, at the time, what happened was that all of his rivals, so Jan Ulrich and Tyler Hamilton, Ivan Basso, they all slowed, noticeably slowed. And over subsequent months, this became a big polemica because Armstrong then, he wrote a second book in which he said, oh, I don't think they waited, those scumbags. And it went on and on and on. But to go back to what I was saying, on this French podcast that was listened to this morning, AMC Grand Plateau, they were talking as though this was a similar scenario, that it was clear that everyone had just sort of sat up and waited for Pogacar because of his status in the peloton. That's not what I saw. That is not what I saw, Larry.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I mean, I was actually surprised when I was watching. So, you know, I actually didn't watch as it happened. I rewatched after. But, you know, so I knew the result. But then when I looked, I was like, wow, they still were going kind of full. You know, I mean, full. Yes, they were going full. You know, I mean, I'm sure they were doing at least 500 watts, which obviously is not easy. But I mean, I think they were going marginally slower than if it was UAE going full from the bottom. But I think they were going very fast because in the end, you know, regardless of who crashed, I mean, even if Poggi didn't crash, it's always a crazy fight into the bottom of Cipressa. And it was still a crazy fight. And you could see how fast the peloton went into the bottom of Cipressa. And then if you do make it there in the top 10 wheels, you're not just going to sit up, you know, because then everyone's going to come around you. So for sure, they still went very hard, maybe slightly slower than if it was UAE going as hard as they possibly could. But, you know, I mean, maybe it could have been like, maybe after like a couple minutes, they maybe went a tiny bit slower, but not, I don't think, because they were waiting for Pogacar, more because I think everyone's like, oh, what do we do? You know, and it's
yeah,
like,
I think we there don't was disorientation, need to push, wasn't
you know?
There? Yeah,
yeah,
there was. A few riders talked about that. Romain Grégoire talked about that. He said no one really knew what was going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think they waited, you know, even though, I mean, yeah, he didn't need them to wait. But I mean, even if it would have been nice or something, but, like, I don't think it was, like, people waited on purpose or anything.
No. So. Another aspect that we briefly mentioned on Saturday, but again, maybe relates to the controversial Lance Armstrong in 2003. And this is a phenomenon we do see fairly regularly, Larry, is the big adrenaline rush after a crash, and whether that was a bit of a propellant for Pogacar as well. Is that something that you've experienced and that is common knowledge among riders, that you can go maybe a little bit harder, faster after a crash if you need to?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I still think a crash takes a lot out of you. But I do think, I mean, the one thing I'd say like the adrenaline rush does is like, for sure you don't feel the pain of the crash as much right after. You know, like, I mean, you feel the crash way more after the race than you do in the race, you know? In the race, you don't feel it that much. So, yeah, that's probably the extra adrenaline. But, I mean, maybe. I mean, I read, an article where, like, Bonifazio said, oh, for sure, like, the adrenaline helped him go faster up Chipresa. I'm pretty sure he would have gone just as fast up Chipresa if he didn't crash, you know? So, you know, maybe even faster. But...
This reminds me of a story that we pursued in vain for several days on the Giro d'Italia a few years ago. I don't know if you were there, Larry. We'd heard a sort of urban legend that Bauke Mollema was stopping for a pee at the bottom of climbs, just before climbs, because nothing to do with the convoy and getting shelter in the cars, because he supposedly had concluded that it was beneficial for him to chase hard before a climb, and that this subsequently affected his performance in a positive way on the climb.
Yeah, right.
When we finally spoke to him about this, I think he laughed us out of the mix zone. But anyway, I don't know how that started or who spread it. Anyway,
I mean, that's a pretty funny one. But I don't think anyone would be purposely extending the effort of the climbs, that's for sure.
Larry, a couple of other things I wanted to mention. Something about, we don't often learn new things about Pogacar, but something I learned at the weekend. And there was this great quote from him about only going back to San Remo for focaccia. Of course, San Remo is in Liguria, famous for its focaccia, the Italian flatbread. He said, yeah, I'll only go back in future for the focaccia in San Remo. His name, Pogacar, is supposedly, etymologically, supposedly derived from the pogača, which is a sort of version, a variety of a focaccia-like bread.
No way.
In Slovenia. True.
That's insane.
True story.
Just funny because everyone calls him Tade Focaccia, but I just thought it was because pogača sounds like focaccia.
True story, Larry. I read an even more elaborate explanation, which was that...
Was this the same person who told you about Bauke Mollema?
On a same theme, Pogacari, relatives and friends who come to a wedding party from the bride's side and bring a pogača, they are known as Pogacari in Slovenian, I believe. Anyway, how that relates to Tadej Pogacar's future in Milan-San Remo, I don't know. Larry, do you think he'll go back?
I think he'll still go back, whether it's next year or another time. But, you know, I mean, he really wanted to win that one. And I think it really caused him a lot of stress not being able to win for so many years, you know, because I think it's the only race that he really set his mind to that he wasn't able to, you know, come super close to the victory. You know, I mean, what was last year? His first Roubaix and he was second or something. You know, it's like, I'm pretty sure Roubaix, it's going to be easy. You know, I mean, not easy, but like more achievable, you know, because like the differences in strength really come to the fore in that race. Whereas like, you know, in San Remo, as long as someone can stick on his wheel, they'll probably be able to beat him in the sprint. So I think it was so... I think it was just a lot of stress for him because he's like, I think he probably also, it's just, he wants to win all the five monuments. Right. And that was probably the most difficult one. So I think he probably wants to avoid that stress for a while. And it's a stressful race as well. So, I could see that's why he wouldn't be in a rush to go back, but I imagine at some point he'll go back. But yeah, you know, I mean, he like revolved this whole winter training around trying to, win San Remo. You know, he was like, I think he said he was three times a week in the gym this winter trying to just be able to sprint faster and, you know, like just for San Remo, essentially, because he just so wanted to win. So, you know, I think he'll be happy to have achieved that goal. And I don't think he'll be in a rush to like, yeah, go back, because I think it's going to be hard to win it again, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we said at the weekend it was like bottling lightning for a rider of his characteristics, which made it all the more sort of exciting and impressive. Larry, next on my list of Pogacar and Sanremo related topics. A lot of people on social media talked about motorbikes after the race on Saturday. Now, there is an element of talking about motorbikes, Larry, I've noticed, after big bike races, is a bit like sort of telling a waiter the wine is corked. It's a little bit like a kind of signposting, you know, you really know. It's an insider observation. It's like to signpost the fact that you really know what you're talking about if you start talking about the motos. I find personally that as an armchair spectator, we're generally watching on the TV, it's quite difficult to tell to what extent the motos are affecting the race. And it's also, Larry, I've very often spoken to riders after races who have said the motos have affected the peloton, and on other occasions, obviously, they talk about the motos affecting and benefiting the brakes. So it can sometimes seem like six of one, half a dozen of the other. There is no doubt that in Milan-San Remo, historically, and we've talked about this before, but if you go back and look at clips from the 1990s, that you get a vast phalanx of motorbikes in front of the lead riders, in front of, yeah, particularly when someone attacks on the Poggio. I mean, it's laughable. On Saturday, there were four or five motorbikes in front of him on the Poggio in particular. Not right sort of in front of his front tyre, but pretty close. However, it does strike me that this is kind of everyone knows, and you know as a rider, you know that this is available. If you strike the first blow, if Pidcock had attacked, this advantage would have been available to him as well. So to say that Pogacar beat Pidcock because of the motorbikes is almost a bit disingenuous.
They're saying it's because... I could see them saying, like, well, they were able to hold off the peloton or something because of the motorbikes. But
I think that's fair. I think that's maybe fair.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Because, like, I mean, Pidcock has the same advantage being with Pogacar, you know? So I don't think that had any bearing on first and second. But, like, you know, I mean, sure, maybe you could make the argument that, like, if there were a bunch of motorbikes super close, I mean, maybe if they weren't there, maybe, like, the peloton would have a better chance. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's just going to be a recurring issue in cycling until it's only drones filming us, you know? Because, I mean, for sure they have a big effect on the draft and, you know, but again, yeah, I mean, I would say 80% of the time, if they're helping the breakaway, they're also helping the peloton, you know? So, you know, I mean, it's tough because, I mean, yes, 100% motorbikes impact the race, you know? But to whose benefit? I don't know, you know? Like, because, yeah, I would say most of the time, if they're in front of the peloton, they're also in front of the breakaway and vice versa. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just part of the nature of filming the sport with a motorbike, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it could be the case that proportionately, on average, they do favour the strongest rider in the race. That, you know, obviously that advantage is most likely to be available for the guy who does get an advantage. So over the years, I'm sure Pogacar has probably benefited from motorbikes to a greater extent than other riders, because he's been off the front on his own. I mean, the other thing in Italy, there is this sort of phenomenon in Italy and with the Italian media, and I think this definitely partly explains why it was so egregious. It used to be so egregious in Milan-San Remo, but they absolutely adore a superstar and an icon. I think you're seeing that now with Pogacar. And, you know, when I've spoken to, for example, Mark Cavendish about this at the Giro d'Italia, the years that he did the Giro d'Italia, races like Milan-San Remo, it's almost embarrassing the extent to which they do sort of roll out the red carpet for icon stars, heroes. And I think I can well imagine that the motorbikes lingered a little bit longer, or were allowed to linger a little bit longer, sort of in the name of that kind of objective of getting their brilliant shot of Pogacar at the weekend.
No, for sure. I mean, yeah, that's also probably true. But I mean, there's also stories of, like, TTs in the Giro and stuff. And, like, you know, the home rider has the randomly has the, or just by chance has the motorbike in front of him very, very, very close. And then, you know, the guy maybe happened to win the race or something, you know, like, yeah. But I don't think that's the same in a road race. You know what I mean? I mean, yes, for sure it impacts a race, but you know, I don't think it's like, there's any conspiracy, you know, around it or anything, you know? I mean, that's just the nature of bike racing, whether that's, yeah, bad or good or what, I don't know.
Okay. Last thing on Pogacar, Larry, obviously after he did win at the weekend, one of the narratives for this year, and we knew it would be a narrative, was going to be how boring everything was with him winning. That sort of receded a little bit on Saturday because it was such an exciting race, so we didn't get so much of that. But what we did get, and we will get this year, is this sort of bifurcation, I think, of those being seen to sort of celebrate, and the slightly kind of shrill coverage about Pogacar, and the sort of background murmur, and what's more than the murmur in a lot of cases, of suspicion. And we've had some quotes and some coverage since the weekend. There was a former French rider who some listeners may have heard of, Erwan Mentio, whose quotes after the race at the weekend got a lot of airplay. I'll just read a couple of things out. He said, "Frankly, I'm hallucinating. I watched Pogacar race, win, repeat, crush the opposition, recover and start all over again. I just can't swallow the fairy tale we're being fed. A rider who almost never slumps, who moves through the seasons with such insolent consistency, who seems to be able to do everything everywhere all the time. He should spark something other than automatic applause." As I say, we're going to get a lot of this year.
Sounds French.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is an element of that. Erwan Mentio, just to give you a bit of background, he, in 1997, he was one of the first three riders to fail a blood... When blood tests were introduced at the start of that year, he was one of the first three riders, or three who failed at the same time. And he then later wrote a sort of tell-all kind of expose about how he had doped, and he became a sort of born-again kind of evangelist for anti-doping. I've interviewed him in the past. He's become a very successful sort of lifestyle guru. He's someone who is not, who doesn't have a lot of contact with the world of professional cycling nowadays, and which is not to say he's not entitled to his opinion. It did just strike me the weekend that it can feel quite bipolar at the moment in the coverage of cycling, as I touched on a minute ago. On the one hand, as we get the sort of vibesification of the media, and everything is, you know, pictures on, or sort of reels on Instagram of people celebrating, going crazy about Pogacar and that style of coverage. And then on the other hand, sort of reactions like I've just read. I mean, it becomes more and more important that me, and I'm not talking about you, Larry, you have a different role in this, but me as the sort of old school, the kind of legacy media, we maintain a sort of sober and open mind, and we remain skeptical. It's our job to be skeptical, not suspicious. And you might say, well, what does skeptical mean? And that's kind of a difficult question to answer, but I suppose a better word to use is open-minded.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, open-minded. Yeah,
yeah,
but I mean, it's the same for me, you know. It's like I mean, you know what, to me it's a bad way to think about it. It's like, just because someone's so good, to question them, you know what I mean? But again, you know, like, you can't rule out the possibility that you know, anyone could be doing something, you know. You know, to me, I just really don't like, you know. And I mean, it's the same in the peloton, you know. I think a lot of guys are like, oh my god, how can he be so good, you know? But I'm like, there is also the chance or probability that, like, this guy just happened to be born the greatest cyclist that ever lived. And he just happened to pick up cycling, you know, in this era or whatever, you know, like that is a very real possibility. And, you know, I think people think, like, there's a lot of riders, they think like, oh, I work so hard, you know, like, I can't imagine how anyone could be so much better than me because I work so hard. But it's like, yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, I'm sure, unfortunately, performance isn't like linear to your work ethic. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not like the harder you work, the better you get, you know, like sometimes you work too hard, you know, then it gets worse, you know? So you know, that's, I think, a plus and a minus of cycling, because it's maybe beautiful because you can't calculate it, but then it's difficult if you're doing it because, like, yeah, you can work so hard and it doesn't always work out. And so, I don't know, it's something that I, you know, maybe some people call me naive or whatever, but I mean, still, I think, like, it's possible that there is just someone that's so far and away better than everyone else. And, you know, it happens once in a couple lifetimes, and maybe that's Tade, you know?
Something we've talked about before, Larry, as well, is that a team, but teams in general, have developed enough knowledge over recent years to engineer races to make sure that the strongest guy, i.e. Pogacar, wins more often than was once the case. You know, we've talked a lot about these fast starts to races, and sort of riding at 35 kilometers an hour in the first hour was never a sensible way. If the outcome that you wanted as a team was for the strongest rider to win because you had the strongest rider, allowing the first sort of hour or 2 hours to be ridden at 35 kilometers an hour, 40 kilometers an hour, was never the best way to do that. Whereas, you know, we've talked about these fast starts, and often it's UAE or they're sort of engineering that, they're ensuring that that happens, and that in more often is going to not guarantee, but it's going to favor the strongest rider winning. Would you
100%?
Yeah.
I mean, no, it's definitely something that's it's just happening more and more. You know, it's like Tirreno, for example. I mean, some of the starts were ridiculously hard, you know, like the first 3 hours of the race were just unreal hard, you know, and then you have to do even harder off of that, you know, and that didn't used to be the case. You know, it used to be like, yeah, you know, you kind of settle into it and then say it was a crescendo towards the finish, you know. and now, I mean, yeah, like Tirreno was, so, you know, we use something called like TSS to like sort of measure how hard a day is and a week is. And, you know, it's sort of like a measure. It's called training stress score. And it's a measure of how hard, you know, a day, like a race is. And like the TSS of Tirreno was the biggest week I think I've ever had in cycling. I didn't measure against Grand Tours, but I also talked to some other riders there, and for them it was the same. So, you know, and compared to the last year, say it was like at least 10% harder, maybe 15% harder than the last year. So, you know, it's just every year that's just increasing. And I think it's because of the way we're racing. You know, it's like you don't just get these easy moments. It's just like on all the time. And yeah, okay, we had one easy day, but it was also because the weather was shit, and you know, so I think it's just explain
how, as I said, that in more often than not, that will ensure or give the best rider a better chance of winning.
So yeah, I mean
it's maybe obvious, but
no, but I mean the difference now is, for example, guys like you know, Pogacar or Vingegaard, these kind of guys, you know, they train in a way that you know, they're more durable, as people like to call it. So, you know, they, I guess the gaps between riders increase more and more the harder the day is. So I guess in the final, right? So if you have like a super easy day, say take like UAE Tour. A lot of times UAE Tour, it's super easy, and then it's one super hard final climb, you know? And there you can see different riders being successful as you would in a classic, you know, like a Liège, a Flanders, things like that. Or even, you know, a mountain stage in a Grand Tour that it's like, you know, four cols or something, you know? So I guess the harder it is over the course of the day, the really great riders, the difference just magnifies, because they're the ones who are still able to do their best effort after like five super hard hours, six super hard hours. And I guess a lot of guys are maybe only able to do that effort once or twice and not like five times. So that's where you just see, so for them riding super hard the whole day, say it puts out, you know, 30% of the guys from the final. So, it just makes their lives easier also.
Larry, I shared some exclusive proprietary research with you recently, didn't I? At my study of first hours in Grand Tours over the last
six years.
Just to give the numbers on that, since 2020, the average speed of first hours in major tours, so in 2020 the average was just under 45 kilometers an hour in 2020, and in 2025 the average speed for the first hour in Grand Tours was over 48 kilometers an hour, and it's gone up every year. It's kind of looking exponential at the moment. Anyway, that, Larry, is that. I think that was all I wanted to say about Pogacar. That was the last thing, Larry. Just you said, you talked there about kind of the mood in the peloton, the feeling in the peloton, and this is, you've been an important gauge of this for us over the years, because we've spoken about this a few times. But how has the needle moved over the last 3 or 4 years as he's won more, obviously, as he's become more dominant? Do you hear more of that than you used to, a different volume?
No, I think it's quarters. Always, it's been about the same. I don't know. But, you know, it happens more. I mean, to me, I don't know why these guys would be like crazy about the San Remo thing. Cause it's like, I mean, he still barely won, you know, to me, what would be like more the one that people would be like, how the heck is this possible, is like Strada, you know, cause then he just smashes everyone, you know, and goes 80K to go and whatever, you know, I mean. That's the one I can see people questioning. You know, for San Remo, to me, I'm like, I mean, he won, but it wasn't like he just absolutely destroyed everyone. You know, I mean, and again, maybe that's a race where, like, you know, there are much smaller differences, but still, like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, so I wouldn't say like after San Remo, I heard anything more. I think actually, to be honest, I think a lot of people are like, damn, that's pretty cool. You know, like, that's pretty badass he was able to win it, you know?
Yeah.
At least to me, I was like, wow, that's sweet, you know? That a guy like that can really, like, set his mind to something that, even if it's not, like, his bread and butter, he can still win, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, and when I talked about that open-mindedness or sort of skepticism earlier, that is always that's going to be a sort of constellation of different things, different factors that you might hear or might, you know, it's a puzzle that you put together. And okay, some people might say that the tiny nugget hint of something about Marc Soler a few weeks ago, that might be in some people's head, that might sense, you know, turn a light bulb on. And then, you know, obviously we know the history of Mauro Gianetti and so on and so forth, and you know, various sort of light bulbs might be going off. But at the moment, it's pretty sort of thin evidence. It's very thin evidence. I mean, I talked earlier about Nairo Quintana. If we had two, I mentioned two things about Nairo Quintana, two huge asterisks. If we had two of those with Pogacar, then I would feel very differently about...
Oh, for sure. But I think we have zero asterisks. It's just like, he goes really fast, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, that seems to be the asterisk that most people, that arouses most suspicion in
most people.
Anyway, Larry, Pogacar.
One more thing about Pogacar is, what the thing that I don't totally understand is, everyone hates on him making cycling less exciting. But I'm like, well, I mean, I think he probably will bring a ton more people to the sport, like, as every single GOAT does, you know? I mean, think, like, I mean, people weren't complaining that, like, Usain Bolt was, like, just, you know, they weren't like, oh, my gosh, he makes track and field boring, you know? They're like, holy crap, like, this guy is unreal, you know? People weren't going like Michael Jordan, like, ah, oh, I mean, this guy, like, he's too good, like, he makes basketball boring. No, they're like, it's amazing. Why is it that just now in cycling, everyone's like, oh, you know, I don't know. Like, to me, it's just, I don't understand why people, again, I mean, for sure, from the inside, you're kind of like, oh, damn, you know, like, who got second, right? You know, like, but still, I don't know. I'm just like, it's kind of funny that people hate on him for being so good, when in so many other sports, it's like people are more celebrated for being so good, you know?
And as I said a few weeks ago, Larry, it will all be over very quickly as well. When the time comes, and when he is beaten, and or the decline starts, it will happen very quickly. So on that, Larry, Tom Pidcock at the weekend, to some people's minds, he may have staked a claim as the heir, the next man in, the man who could slay the dragon. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I was not surprised at all after what he did in Milano-Torino, because, I mean, to me, his performance in Milano-Torino was, like, incredible, because, I mean, the numbers on that climb were super high, and then the way he attacked at the end, I was like, oh, my God, you know, like, that was like an unreal attack, you know? So once I saw that, I was like, oh, wow, this guy's going to be like, he's very much going to be like, I didn't think Pogacar would be able to drop him in Sanremo. But yeah, I have to say his performance was incredibly impressive. You know, I think people thought when he went to Q36.5, that was a bad move at the start, you know? And I think he's just showing time and time again that was actually like maybe the best move he could have done. Because then everything revolved around him and he got all the support he could ever want. So, yeah, I mean, he just keeps showing, like, you know, I think also people thought, oh, yeah, they definitely overpaid. You know, he got a really big contract. But he's definitely showing that he's worth every penny they paid. So, I mean, that's good for him.
Yeah, it sort of feels like one of his old, well, it feels like his old mountain bike setup sort of writ large, where everything revolved around, you know, he had a group of people all around him. He was at the center of everyone's universe, and that team.
And maybe he's the kind of rider that needs that, you know?
Well, it felt like that. It felt like sometimes, whenever another sort of competing force or competing would-be leader was kind of introduced in Ineos, it felt as though he got a little bit lost, or he could get a little bit lost, whereas there's never been any danger of that.
Yeah.
Indeed, very impressive performance from him. Larry, it just occurs to me, Pidcock curiously sort of snubbing, or he's pivoted away from the Cobble Classics. Your friend and compatriot, Matteo Jorgensen, has done the same. Interesting choices. I mean, the Jorgensen one has already been talked about, debated, and so far it looks as though it's working in the sense that he's certainly riding very well. He might not be winning a lot, but he's certainly riding very well. What are your thoughts on those two changes of focus for those two riders?
I mean, I think for both of them, the Ardennes actually suit them better. And I think it's very hard to do both, you know? So I think it's better to focus on one or the other if you really want to perform at your best in either of them. So, you know, I think for Matteo, it's just, yeah, they said, okay, we want you to focus on the Ardennes. You know, maybe they don't have a bunch of guys for the Ardennes, and that's like an important opening. Whereas like maybe they have a few more guys for the Cobble Classics. So for them, they'd rather him focus on the Ardennes. And to me, that's definitely the move, because I think if you are the strongest, that's where you can really see the differences. Whereas, you know, in the Cobble Classics, you have to be the strongest and you have to have good luck, kind of, you know? I mean, you also have to be just like a warrior. And he's really good at that kind of racing. But, you know, I think for both of those guys, the Ardennes actually do suit them better. You know, it's just they're more suited to their type of rider. And, you know, they're both just incredibly strong, and especially on like 5-minute climbs, things like that. So yeah, I just think that's probably a good move.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also sponsored by NordVPN, the fastest virtual private network in the world. I've been a NordVPN customer for a long time now, and with the Easter holidays coming up, I find that planning a trip abroad is when my NordVPN subscription really comes into its own. Maybe you're going on holiday this Easter, or perhaps you're planning a trip over to see one of the classics in northern France or Belgium. A NordVPN subscription would really come in handy, because it will keep all of your data safe and secure and protect your online identity whenever and however you are connected up to the internet. Perhaps using the 5G or connected using the Wi-Fi in the hotel, NordVPN gives you the peace of mind to know that those connections are all safe and secure. There are other benefits too, especially at this time of year when you're away on holiday, or maybe you're following the spring classics. Perhaps you want to stream the races. Well, a NordVPN subscription enables you to switch your location and carry on streaming your favourite sporting events and other subscription services as if you were at home. Now, as you're a listener to the Cycling Podcast, go to nordvpn.com/TCP, sign up for a 2-year plan, and you'll get 4 months extra for free. That's nordvpn.com/TCP for a 2-year plan that will give you 4 months extra for free. Now, before I hand back to Daniel and Larry, a quick mention for our Friends of the Podcast program of episodes. A subscription gives you access to the full back catalogue of more than 300 episodes of Kilometre Zero that we've released over the past decade or so, and everything that we release in the upcoming year if you sign up for an annual subscription. The most recent series is called Roadbook, and it's an accumulation of memories and tips and advice for watching the Spring Classics based on my 25 years experience of going over to Europe to watch the major races. The Milan-San Remo episode came out just before La Primavera, and the Flanders Classics episode is online now. If you're a current friend of the podcast, those episodes will have appeared in your feed automatically. If you'd like to sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Every subscription helps to keep the show on the road, and we really appreciate every one of our listeners who chooses to support us by signing up as a friend of the podcast. I've also bumped up the old Lionel of Flanders series, recorded in 2017, feels like a long time ago now. During the races building up to the Tour of Flanders, we went to Dwars door Vlaanderen, the E3 Classic, and Gent-Wevelgem, as it was known then, and that five-part series, the Lionel of Flanders, well, I really enjoyed making it, and I think a lot of listeners enjoyed listening to it. I bumped it up to the top of the feed, so it maybe will whet the appetite for the cobbled races to come. Also at thecyclingpodcast.com, you can sign up for the 1101 Cappuccino, our email distributed by Substack. It's free of charge, and it will keep you up to date with what's going on with the podcast, various random thoughts and ramblings about professional cycling from me as well. So thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up as a friend of the podcast or to receive the 1101 Cappuccino. That's more than enough from me. Back to Daniel and Larry.
Well, Larry, we ended the last part talking about Cobbled Classics versus Ardennes Classics. Of course, the Cobbled Classics are coming. They are imminent now, starting in the next couple of days. In fact, Larry, with Classics starting, Cobbled Classics starting, we are, well, Stacey Snyder, our good friend, is making some cups again, making the wonderful cups to which previously we featured in Grand Tours. She's making them for the Cobbled Classics this time. They're going to go on sale on March 29th. That is Sunday, the day of Gent-Wevelgem. We're going to continue to call it Gent-Wevelgem. I'm not even going to look up what it's supposed to be called now, Gent-Wevelgem. So Sunday, 29th of March, 10 a.m. US East Coast time. They're going to go on sale. They'll be listed on Stacey's Etsy site, which is www.etsy.com/shop/Snyder. That's Snyder ceramics, all one word. And 50% of the proceeds will be donated to the West Lothian Cycle Circuit, which we've supported, or Stacey supported before, with the sale of her cups, and indeed the homage to Richard Moore on the Buffalo Bend up there on the West Lothian Cycle Circuit. Larry, it is classics season approaching, and well, one of our regular correspondents, friends, voices that our listeners enjoy hearing on the podcast, Hugo Corvitz, is practically, well, he's beside himself because his neck of the woods he's already being invaded by the stars of the classics. So let's take this week's detour to Corvitz Corner.
Pay attention, freebie. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Almost all the big stars of the one-day races have landed in our corner. The hotels and bed and breakfasts are filling up with cycling tourists coming from all corners of the world. I can't leave my street without the cycling popping up left and right, heading to the Oude Quaremond or the Mushroom Hill in Tichem. And yet, times have changed. In the past, the Adriarelbeke was the ultimate test for the Ronde van Vlaanderen at Easter. Anyone who didn't finish in the top 15 knew they wouldn't be competing for the podium in Oudenaarde. It is really no coincidence that Tom Boonen won Harelbeke 5 times and Fabian Cancellara and Johan Museeuw 3 times each. No, in modern cycling, everything is truly different. You fall for the Cipressa, a win the Primavera in a 2-man sprint. If your name is Podjakar, you stay home this weekend and let the domestics race freely for a change. Pogačar waited the competition years ago and found it wanting. The world champion rode Harald Bicker once and never Hent Wevelhem. With the exception of the Strade Bianche, only the true monuments of cycling interest him. So for Harald Bicker, we end up with only Mathieu van der Poel and Mats Pedersen. It was not yet certain on Tuesday afternoon whether Van Aert would ride Harald Bicker. 48 hours before the start, he decided not to go to Harald Bicker and only ride Hent Wevelhem as foreseen in the beginning of the season. Only after Sunday did Van Aert decide whether to add Dwars door Vlaanderen and Waregem to his schedule. Harald Bicker has always been a mini Ronde van Vlaanderen, but with the Carnaval Big Straat and the Oude Quaremont twice now, it becomes even tougher. As if Harald Bicker wasn't selective enough already. Perhaps that suits Mats Pedersen better. The Dane had to wait until last year to finally reach the podium and finish second behind MVDP. The Danish ex-world champion is a man after my own heart. He's the only one of the four-leaf clover riding through the sacred Flemish weeks in good old-fashioned style. He starts anytime and anywhere, including Dwars door Vlaanderen next Wednesday. He is also the only one who can set a new race record this weekend. He can win Hent Wevelhem for the fourth time on the Van Akkerestraat. That is a classic with a profile entirely his own. Oh well, nowadays you have to talk about in Flanders fields from Middelkerk to Wevelhem. By the time you finished saying the name of the race, Pedersen has already crossed the finish line.
Larry, good to hear Hugo taking umbrage and railing as well all these name changes. He's not on board with it either. I wasn't even aware of the Depana one, which is now, what is it, Tour of Bruges? That's going on at the moment.
I didn't know. Oh, that's... I was like, I never heard of this race before. Because it's this weekend, I guess, yeah. Anyway, I saw like some race, Tour of Bruges. I was like, oh, that's a new race. Interesting. Okay. I didn't realize that was Depana. Okay.
In fairness, they have changed the name partly because the race has moved away from Depana. So there's at least some justification.
Logical,
yeah, there's at least some justification. They're lesser, and Gent-Wevelgem has always moved around, but it could still have been called Gent-Wevelgem. What others have we had this year? We've had Paris-Roubaix. We've had the Dauphiné. They're all called something different now, so you'll have to look them up. I'm not going to help you with that.
Yeah.
But on Friday, so we've got E3 on Friday, which also changes name every year. But it's, I think everyone knows that it's kind of the baby tour of Flanders. And we've got a bit of team news. Hugo gave us that. There's going to be no Pogacar, no Van Aert at the last minute. He's pulled out. And Mats Pedersen, we think, is going to be there. And Mathieu van der Poel is also going to be there. Of course, Van der Poel's won the last two editions. Wout van Aert won the two before that. Last year, just to refresh your memory, 80 kilometres to go, Mats Pedersen tried to split the race on the Tyrannberg. He kind of succeeded. He dragged Van der Poel and Ganna away with him, but then Van der Poel rode away on the Oude Quaremont with 39 kilometres to go and won by over a minute. Oude Quaremont, two ascents of that climb, obviously one of the iconic climbs of the Tour of Flanders this year, so it's kind of been toughened up and made hillier again, as is sort of the fashion now in one day races, around 3,000 metres of climbing, the new route there. So it should be an interesting one. Larry, you won't have gone to altitude on Friday, will you, yet? You'll be tuning in.
No,
I presume.
I leave Saturday.
Talk to me a little bit about Tudor's Cobbled Classics campaign. What you're not involved, but what is the team hoping for, and who are going to be the stars?
I mean, I think they'll probably be hoping for some good results. You know, the opening weekend went pretty darn well with Trentin and Mozzato going third and second in Kerner-Brussels-Kerner. So that was great. And for sure, it's going to be those two guys are probably going to be the headliners, let's say. You know, I think Trentin, he's on super good form, and I think he'll only be getting better through all those races. So yeah, I think we can expect some good rides from him. And then, yeah, I think Mozzato, he's like, yeah, he's a super good rider and he's just so good in the bunch. And he's just, yeah, really good at being in the right place at the right time. So hopefully we can see some good rides from both of them. Then we also have Rick Ploymers, who's pretty strong and seems to get better every year. So I think the three of them will be really like the guys to watch out for. Unfortunately, you know, we did have Stefan Kung, but he is out for the whole, at least spring classic season. So that's too bad.
Larry, obviously, well, this is our new obsession, the UCI points. It's the first year of the 3-year cycle, but going into first season of three, classics, Cobble Classics is the priority. Results, the prestige per se of big results in the classics, or is it points accumulation?
Well, I think it's both, you know. I mean, ideally accumulating points by getting prestigious results, you know. So I think, you know, our team is definitely someone who's like, we focus on the win, you know, we focus on getting the best result possible, and points will come with that. You know, they're never going to be like, okay guys, we want six guys to try to race for a top 30 for the points. You know, they'll never say that. You know, it's like, we work for the leader, maybe, you know, a co-leader, but we won't be just like, you know, racing random small races just to try to rack up a bunch of points. But, you know,
Are the points, Larry, are they specified? Is there any director sportif, or have you ever had any experience of any director sportif who will systematically mention how many points are available for every race day they give a briefing for? No,
or at least not on this team. You know, maybe in my last team, every once in a while they would mention things like that. You know, I distinctly remember when sort of like the whole points system really started. They had a meeting with us presenting like the best way to get the most points. And we all left the meeting being like, okay, we just need to send all the best riders to 1.1s, you know, like to smaller races, because that's the way you farm points, you know? But, you know, I would say with Tudor, it's not, they don't go like, guys, it's not never before the race. They go, we need to make sure we get a bunch of points today, you know? But I can tell you that if we aren't getting a lot of points in the race, it's definitely something that's thought about and maybe slightly mentioned, you know, because like it is important and we need to make sure we are, you know, consistently getting points. But it is a shame that this has become such a big thing in cycling now, because in the past, this was never something everyone considered, you know, like no one cared about the team ranking before. And now, you know, in the last 3-5 years, it's like the thing, you know.
And now the UCI have got all these shills with podcasts like me who are promoting this agenda, because I've become slightly obsessed with it, Larry.
It does open up alternate storylines, you know. Like I will say, last year at the end of the season, it made for some interesting alternate storylines about like races inside a race, you know. And, you know, even just things like Astana, everything, you know, that was a pretty crazy storyline that, like, what they did last year, you know, everyone thought that would have been impossible before. So, you know, it definitely makes for some interesting,
yeah,
different stories.
Larry, I don't think you'd have heard it, but a few weeks ago I had a conversation, and we released it as an episode, a conversation with Tom Southam, who's a direct sportif at EF, and one aspect of the race for points that he highlighted, which most of us and I wasn't aware of, and I don't know how much this was Tom and his team are generally broadly against the relegation system, or they don't have a whole lot of time for it. But one aspect that he highlighted was that he thinks that sometimes this race for points, well out of sight and out of mind of most of us, off camera, because it's happening, you know, further back down the road, he thinks that it can be dangerous at times, because it's happening where, you know, there are team cars everywhere, the commissaires aren't looking, and there are guys sort of sprinting, fighting in some cases, almost literally for 30th place.
Bah. I mean, I don't think that makes the racing more dangerous. You know, I mean, there's always been guys fighting for 30th place, you know? It's just now it's actually matters, you know? Like now actually 30th place can mean something in certain races. But I definitely don't think that, to me, that doesn't make the racing more dangerous. You know, I think, you know, the most dangerous is the race for the win, you know, and for sure, you know, I mean, that's always been dangerous, I guess, but, you know, I would guess, yeah, the finals, maybe they're becoming more dangerous, but not because of guys racing for 30th place, you know?
Yeah. I promise you, in a few weeks, we'll stop talking about points.
No, it's okay.
We're in the sort of honeymoon period of just having really learned about this, and we can't stop talking about it now. Okay, so you've got Trentin, Mozzato, you also have Marco Haller, I guess, will be an important rider there. So that's E3 on Friday, and of course we've got Gent Wevelgem on Sunday, where Mads Pedersen will be going for a record fourth win, and he's also won the last two editions, going for three in a row, and if he won for the fourth time in total, that would put him on his own as the only rider to have won four times. And I would suggest, based on the way that Little Trek rode at the weekend and the way he rode himself, he is in pretty good shape and has a pretty good chance of doing that. Larry, final thing I wanted to ask you about today. We've had a couple of stages, and indeed the third stage is going on at the moment, of the Volta a Catalunya. Remco Evenepoel in action there, Jonas Vingegaard among the sort of bill-topping riders. But on the first day, we had another victory for your former teammate Dorian Godon, which didn't surprise me, I must admit, and it didn't surprise me when he won the stage at Paris-Nice either, because you've talked to us before about how strong he is on that kind of finish, and I've seen it myself. I saw it at the Giro del Veneto on Monte Berico a few years ago, but he really seems to be developing sort of awareness.
Blossoming.
And he's he's becoming aware of exactly how strong he is and exactly what he can achieve on the right type of courses.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think anyone who has been teammates with him or raced with him knows how strong he is, you know, and knows how strong he's been. Because if you knew what you were looking at in the past, you know, sometimes he'd start 35th wheel in a group of 30 and then be third at the finish. You know, I mean, like, so I think now with Ineos, they probably recognized his potential maybe more than Decathlon did. And I think they've just enabled him to use that potential well. You know, I think, you know, now he really has a full squad working for him in a final when it suits him, and then he delivers, you know, which is so cool. You know, I think if he's the kind of guy, if you just tell him, you need to follow this guy, you need to stay on this guy's wheel, you know, he will do that, you know. Mm. But if it's just kind of like, yeah, whatever, he's just kind of like, yeah, whatever, you know. So I think probably being in a team like Ineos that functions more like a well-oiled machine and, you know, probably has very concrete objectives and, you know, moments that he needs to be at the front and whatever, I think that probably works extremely well for him. And now we're seeing the results. So that's really cool because, I mean, I've known that he's been capable of doing this, and I'm just happy to see that, he's delivering and it's working out.
Yeah, some guys not suited to the French brand, that particular French brand of pourquoi pas cycling, you know.
Yeah,
everyone, exactly, pourquoi pas? Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Larry, anything else you'd like to share with us in part and before you head off to the heights? Any other gossip?
gossip, I don't know.
It's
you were
right.
talking
it's...
about Mads Pedersen, and I was thinking how, I don't know, we'll see if he's ready, because the other week my girlfriend passed him in training, and she came home and she's like, oh, I think I passed two Trek people, you know? But I was going so fast, I just went straight by them, you know? And she's like, who do you think they were? I was like, oh, I don't know, you know, what did they look? Oh, they were big, but I was probably Mads Pedersen. She goes, oh my gosh, can you imagine? I passed Mads Pedersen, you know? I mean, they never caught me. Like, I went past them and they never caught me. And I was like, okay, you know, good job. Maybe my girlfriend should be a favorite for Gent-Wevelgem.
Well, your girlfriend is French, so pourquoi pas? Pourquoi pas?
Yeah, exactly.
Larry, well, you enjoy yourself up there in Sierra Nevada, and we will reconvene at some point, maybe when you are in Sierra Nevada, whiling away what would otherwise be boring afternoons at 2,600 meters altitude. But yeah, train well, enjoy yourself, and thank you very much for your company today. And thank you to the listeners as well for their hopefully rapt attention.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.